You know how much art that is? Or the effort that would go into a book like that? No way, Jose. There aren't enough hours in the day or days in the year. It would take forever. Sober up. I'm glad that no one dissuaded Jared Walters, because he was crazy enough to pursue his mad dream, for which we are all indebted. Almost all the art was shot from the originals or color-adjusted scans of the original art, instead of printed pages overlaid with type. In other words, Jared went above and beyond, to the point where he commissioned artists to render new pieces just for this project. Karen Haber of Locus, October 2010, sang the book's praises. From the first glance at the slipcover of Knowing Darkness, Artists Inspired by Stephen King, with its lunatic, demon-possessed lawman from Desperation, painted by Don Mates, or the flip side with its dark portrait of Randall Flagg, arch-villain of The Stand, as rendered by the late Don Brodigan, you know you are in for a wild ride. What else would you expect from a giant volume filled with art inspired by the Master of Darkness? The only thing missing is a sound chip implanted in the cover to provide a faint scream or anguished groan as the book is opened. With this beautiful volume and its predecessor, A Lovecraft Retrospective, 2008, Centipede Press has set the bar even higher for fine art book publishing, and for weight training on the part of any readers who hope to read this 13-pound book. Centipede's second mammoth tribute volume measures 11 by 15 inches, with 448 pages and over 500 illustrations, including 30 double-page foldouts. This definitive collection of art spans King's 35-plus-year career, with newly commissioned artwork and reprinted art. The lineup reads like a who's who of dark fantasy, science fiction, and horror artists, represented by a wide variety of media, including collages, scratchboard, oils, acrylics, watercolors, graphite pencil, photographs, and digital art. As if the artwork and essays weren't enough, the sheer quality of the physical materials used to create the book inspires admiration. The heavy matte varnished paper, the sewn-in binding and ribbon bookmarks, and custom-fitted illustrated slipcases. Like Harlan Ellison, who is an ardent collector of artwork, especially pieces illustrating his book covers and interiors, Stephen King is also a collector and has several fine pieces in his collection, including a Phil Hale piece from the limited edition of The Talisman, a Jeffrey Jones painting from the same edition, and a gorgeous Michael Whalen painting from the seventh book in the Dark Tower series, titled The Dark Tower. Moreover, King, like most writers, is very concerned about cover art, for the simple reason that even though you can't judge a book by its cover, it's what the potential customer sees before he opens the book for a sample reading. As booksellers will tell you, when a potential customer is browsing a book in a retail store, he's halfway to a sale when it's picked up. The cover is not mere decoration, but an essential sales tool. It explains why publishers go out and hire the best cover artists, Michael Whalen, Drew Struzan, Bernie Wrightson, and others, because their work helps draw you into the book. Knowing Darkness remains a testament to the many artists who have illustrated King's work, and it'd be impossible to do them all justice in this book. So I'd like to concentrate on Bernie Wrightson, who has illustrated the most diverse selection of King books. Creepshow, Cycle of the Werewolf, From a Buick 8, The Stand, The Dark Tower, The Wolves of the Kala, and art for TV Guide's cover story on The Shining. Bernie Wrightson, 2009. When I was working on Knowing Darkness, Artists Inspired by Stephen King, I especially enjoyed interviewing as many artists as possible. Some of them I had not known, but I'm glad to say I've known Bernie since the 70s when he burst on the comic book scene and made everyone sit up and pay attention. One look at his work, the draftsmanship, the humor, the sheer inventiveness of his graphic storytelling skills, was enough to show that he was destined for great things. Early on, he showed considerable promise, and in the years that followed, Bernie delivered. His masterpiece is surely his series of pen and ink illustrations for Frankenstein, which has seen print by 3 publishers so far. The best, in my opinion, is from Dark Horse Books, October 2008, which, unfortunately, is out of print. Fortunately, it is available on the secondary market, and it is well worth your time to track down a copy to add to your collection. If Franklin Booth, another great pen and ink artist, had seen Burney's work on Mary Shelley's haunting novel, he'd whistle in admiration. Yeah, Burney's work on Frankenstein is that good. Switching gears here, the best interviews are conducted in person at a creator's studio, because that's where he is most comfortable. He's in his element, relaxed, and won't be interrupted as he would in a more public environment, like a convention. Fortunately, I was able to conduct an interview for Knowing Darkness with Burney at his studio. I was with veteran Disney artist Tim Kirk in Burney's studio, a small but cozy apartment crammed with a lifetime of collecting curiosities both mundane and macabre. Skeletal models of dinosaurs, a life-sized human figure showing musculature and bones, figurines of Dracula, Frankenstein, the Bride of Frankenstein, and the Creature from the Black Lagoon. Angelic figurines. A shelf crammed with unabridged audiobooks of fiction by Stephen King and J.K. Rowling. Shelves crammed with books on art, anatomy, history, and novels. And in every nook and cranny, paintbrushes sprouting from tin cans and glass jars. Burney's studio was exactly as I had imagined it. A cross between a young boy's toy shop and a biological specimen house. Clearly, buried within the adult are the sensibilities of a little boy who delights in artifacts of innocence and experience. His world is suffused with popular culture, fueling his wondrously macabre imagination. One can say the same about Stephen King, who is 1 year older than Burney. Growing up in the 50s, in the shadow of the atomic bomb, against the backdrop of the Cold War, both Burney and Stephen lived at a time when the United States enjoyed a post-war boom, making it the preeminent world power militarily and economically. The two both grew up in blue-collar households where money was tight. They both haunted movie theaters, watching endless B-movies showing mutated insects, people, and monsters, all accidental victims of radiation poisoning. The two devoured pop fiction in well-thumbed paperback books and comic books, especially Bill Gaines's lurid line of comics. Science fiction, suspense, and horror rendered in exquisite detail and 4-color by Frank Frazetta, Wally Wood, Jack Davis, and others. "We didn't have books in the house," Burney recalled, "but we had comics. My mom read romance comics, my dad read war comics, and I got Superman and Donald Duck." But in a scene reminiscent of Creepshow, Burney's mom threw out his collection of horror comics because she perceived them as being trash, which is where they ended up, to his dismay. Years later, as adults, both Burney and Stephen tapped into the latent power of the outsider, a staple in pop culture. Rights in Swamp Thing, who reared up out of the wetland, and King's young adults, Carrietta Carrie White, Carrie, Arnie Cunningham, Christine, and Charlene Charlie McGee, Firestarter. Fueled by endless cups of black coffee, chain-smoking cigarettes, and glazed donuts, Burney sat back to relax behind his drawing table. He took a long drag on his cigarette, exhaled slowly as smoke eddied and filled the room, and got down to the business at hand, talking non-stop for the next 4 hours. A longtime collector of his work, I have his retrospective collection, A Look Back, and his classic Frankenstein on my shelf, and I also have many of his art prints. I'd met him through my associations with Vaughn Bodie and Jeffrey Jones, two of the finest artists to emerge out of the comics field. Vaughn passed away in 1975 at age 33, and Jeff in 2011. Those were heady days for art collectors. I was at a Phil Suling Comic-Con in 1971 talking to Russ Cochran, who had just begun representing Frank Frazetta. Russ had one of Frazetta's paintings for $700. We witnessed one fan complain about the price, saying that no one would ever pay that much money for a painting by him. Flash forward to 2010. A Frazetta painting of Conan the Barbarian sells for $1.5 million. Who would have guessed that comic books would be four-color treasures the likes of which Smaug would have hoarded? That original art from comics and paperback book covers would be worth a king's ransom? Our parents never knew. They considered it all junk. But we knew better. What follows are observations from Bernie from my interviews with him over the years, some with explanatory texts by me on some of Bernie's King-related projects. Stephen King's Creepshow, New American Library, Trade Edition, 1982. King was in Pittsburgh. I don't know how much time he spent there, but he was filming his segment, The Lonely Death of Geordie Verrill, in which he was cast as a country bumpkin. I got a call one night. My wife gets the phone, hands it to me, and tells me it's Stephen King. Yeah, right. I'm thinking it's a prank from one of my friends, like Bruce Jones. Is this Bernie? This is Steve King. Wow, I thought. It's really him. I'm in Pittsburgh, and I'm working on a movie with George Romero. You know George Romero, right? Sure, I said. Night of the Living Dead. We're working on a movie. It's an anthology movie with several stories from a horror comic. We are working with EC artist Jack Kamen, who is also working on the movie. We assumed Jack was doing the comic book version, but when we asked him about it, he said he didn't know what we were talking about. Stephen King said, "Is there any possibility that you could do the comic book?" And at the time, there was something else I had to put aside to take it on. They wanted the whole thing done in 2 months, but it took me 4 months to do it. I probably put the most work into The Crate and Geordie Verrill. Those were my two favorite segments from the movie. The Crate, because it's a movie within a movie, and Geordie Verrill, because it was played for laughs. The graphic novel was published in July 1982. The cover was by Jack Kamen, but the interiors were by Bernie. The contents included Father's Day, The Lonesome Death of Geordie Verrill, The Crate, Something to Tide You Over, and They're Creeping Up on You. A homage to the EC Comics line, this movie tie-in edition ran 64 pages. Cycle of the Werewolf, The Land of Enchantment, Limited and Trade Edition, 1983. Signet Trade Edition, 1985. The Land of Enchantment publisher, Chris Saviza, put that whole thing together. It was his idea for a long time to do a project with Stephen King, with me as the illustrator. Chris wanted to do new material, a small project that he could handle as a specialty publisher. We were talking about it, and Chris came up with the idea of doing a calendar. It'd almost have to be a werewolf story because the only thing all the months have in common was a full moon. What I wanted to do would tie in with the dates of the calendar. Whatever year this was coming out, we'd time it so that the events were happening on the same day as the calendar with the full moons. After we got this all worked out, Chris approached King, who seemed excited by the whole idea. King started working on it as a calendar project. Each story was to be several paragraphs, a block of copy under the illustration, and under this, the calendar itself. As he was writing, King said the story began to grow on him, and he couldn't contain it to just a few paragraphs per month. Finally, it was becoming obvious that it was not going to be a calendar. King sent me the finished book version, and I just did the illustrations. The Stand, The Complete and Uncut Edition, Doubleday, Limited and Trade Edition, 1990. Bernie was commissioned by Stephen King to illustrate the book and did so with 12 pen and ink pieces that add a visual cachet to the expanded edition. The original edition, published in 1978, lacked illustrations. With a mixture of pieces rendered in a film noir style and a sweeping landscape recalling his work in The Cycle of the Werewolf, The illustrations are among Burney's best work. The artwork was subsequently published as a separate portfolio of art from Glimmer Graphics, 1,200 sets out of print. Nakatomi, NakatomiInc.com, which publishes Wrightson's prints, told me that it is planning to eventually publish a portfolio of 10 prints, each signed by Wrightson in a small run of 60 sets. I did 12 pen and ink interior illustrations. The deal was done with Stephen, who commissioned and paid for them, and not with the publisher. I worked from both the original and revised versions of the book. There are two or three drawings that, if you haven't read the excised stuff, you wouldn't know what it's from. In the revised version, there's material involving the trash can man that is really going to change your mind about how you are going to feel about him. And bits and pieces here and there that clarify things or add another dimension to it. And some material involving a new character that is just some of the creepiest stuff you'll ever read. From a Buick 8, Cemetery Dance, Limited and Trade Edition, 2002. The limited edition is illustrated with color illustrations that draw on Burney's strengths as an illustrator. Because monsters are his strong suit, his visual interpretation of the alien creature from another world strikes all the right notes. There's three plates of an alien-looking creature who opens a portal in his attempt to transport Ned Wilcox into its world. The juxtaposition of the real and the unreal, the setting of a state police barracks in western Pennsylvania, is stark. One illustration shows the horrified look of state troopers as they stand outside a garage and stare with incredulity through the garage windows to see lightning crackle inside housing what appears to be, but is clearly not, a Buick Roadmaster. The Dark Tower, The Wolves of Kala, Donald M. Grant, Publisher, Limited Edition, 2003. It's September 21st, 1998, Stephen King's 51st birthday, and he's on the set of The Green Mile, directed by Frank Darabont with Bernie Wrightson present. As Bernie recalled, "I got to see King in the electric chair and writhe around and make faces." At that informal gathering, King told Bernie, "Oh, by the way, I was wondering if you'd be interested in illustrating the next Dark Tower book." Bernie immediately agreed. Though it had been a while since he had read them and would need to reread them before tackling the art. Time, though, was not a problem. Bernie told me, "I got jury duty right around that time and I had to be downtown every day for over 2 weeks. In fact, I had to be on call at the courthouse for almost 3 weeks because of jury selection for two murder trials. I had nothing to do all day but read the Dark Tower books. It was great. I read them one after the other, and then read the manuscript of The Wolves of the Kala." He added, "When I'm illustrating a book, I'll read the whole thing and bookmark the scenes that immediately stand out. Then I go back and reread those passages. I consider their spacing throughout the book because I don't want the illustrations too close to one another, or to have too long a stretch without one. With Steve's writing, though, there's a picture on almost every page, so it was very easy to pick out the standout moments." Bernie recalled, "During that time, Steve sent me a letter saying he was glad I was on board. He told me, 'If you don't mind, I have a list of suggestions for scenes. I'm not art directing by any means, but these are scenes that I would like to see illustrated. If you agree, that's fine, and if not, just illustrate the scenes you want.'" As it turned out, King's list of 12 scenes were exactly the ones I picked. I wrote back to tell him he had picked the best scenes, the same ones I had picked. They were also spaced exactly right throughout the body of the book. TV Guide, The Shining Issue, April 26, 1997. For a cover story on King's remake of The Shining, starring Steven Weber as Jack and Rebecca De Mornay as Wendy, Bernie Wrightson provided a color painting for the cover of TV Guide and an interior illustration for Before the Play. As TV Guide noted, Weber knew that King didn't want another psycho Jack Nicholson. The story King wanted to tell emphasized a family torn apart by a much more prevalent demon, alcohol. "It's not just about a big star going mad," Weber says. De Mornay agrees. "When I first saw the script, I thought, who are they kidding? They're going to do this again?" But this script had nothing to do with the movie. It haunted me. It was a metaphor for the classic American alcoholic dysfunctional family, where the real ghost in the family is rage. Bernie's painting of a snowy winter's night, with Jack Torrance in the foreground and the Overlook Hotel in the background, grabs your attention, as does his interior illustration for King's Before the Play, depicting Lottie Kilgallen, who reaches for cigarettes on the floor and has her wrist grabbed by a man under the bed. 35. Stephen King. A Chautauqua in Pasadena, California. I can't really lecture. I'm not good at that. And I can't speak with any sense from prepared notes. About the most I can do is Chautauqua, a fine old word that means you babble on for a little while about the things that you do and then you sit down. Stephen King in his introductory comments to a public talk in Virginia Beach, Virginia, in 1986. I was at the Virginia Beach lecture for which King solicited questions from the audience to be submitted in writing prior to his talk. He pulled out a few at random, answered them, and decided to take questions from the audience instead, saying he prefers live interaction. Immediately, hands went up, as they always do when he appears in public, because people are curious about him and his work. I've been to several of his talks, and the audience questions are repetitive. At the Pasadena talk, King answers a lot of the most commonly asked questions his readers pose to him. The following quotes are from his Q&A after his informal talk. On lobsters. "For a lot of my childhood, I grew up where I live now, which is Maine. We used to eat a lot of lobster, a poor man's steak. We always used to get seconds, particularly in the summer. Whatever was left over at the end of the day, you could buy for $1 a pound. Some kid told me that if you bought a lobster and cracked open the tail, there's a nerve dangling down its back, and if you eat that, you'd be paralyzed. I know it's not true, but I can't bring myself to eat that black thread. On a fearful imagination. I relate to the kid who is afraid because he's heard his father talking about the Twilight doubleheader, a monster that he thinks is in his closet. On his fan mail. You'd be surprised at some of the letters I get. There are some strange people out there, present company excepted, of course. On symbolism in horror stories and films. They are unreal symbols of very real fears. I don't think that horror fiction works unless you are talking in two voices. On one level, in a very loud voice, you are screaming at your audience about ghosts, werewolves, and shape changers, and in another, very low voice, a whisper, you are talking about real fears. So that in the best cases, you are trying to achieve that nightmarish feeling we've all had. We know it's not real, but that doesn't matter anymore. When I can get that, I know I've got people right where I want them." On why he writes horror fiction. "I like to scare people." On whether or not he's ever going to write serious fiction. "I'm serious-minded whenever I sit down, regardless of what I'm writing about." On whether evil exists. "I'm haunted by the idea that there's some kind of outside evil, something that almost floats free. I worry about guys like Ted Bundy. Whatever it was that was in him was gone when they put him in the electric chair. They fried a shell. Maybe whatever it was blew away." On a ghost. "I have seen a ghost. It's a real ghost story. He was at a political fundraiser event in 1984 and went upstairs to retrieve his and Tabitha's coats. I realized there was a man sitting by the window across the room, so I raised my head slightly to bring him into sight. Through my glasses, I saw a bald 70-year-old man with round glasses. He was wearing a blue pinstripe suit. I began to feel very strongly that this man thought I was looking through the coats to see what I could steal, and I was feeling more and more uncomfortable. I finally said, "Gee, it sure is hard to find coats when people come in." And as soon as those words came out of my mouth, I realized that the chair was totally empty. Nobody was sitting there. My reaction to this was to get our coats and say nothing whatsoever about it. We got halfway to the restaurant where we were going to eat dinner, and inside my mind I stopped and said to myself, "Now wait a minute. The guy was there. You saw him. Why are you pushing this away? You never took your eyes off him." My guess is that's about as exciting as most psychic phenomena get. On his writing speed, I write very fast. On his storytelling process, I usually know where I'm going, and I usually have an idea about what the end is going to be. I think some of you who have read my books would be surprised to find out how many of them were intended to be much bleaker than they turned out to be. For instance, I expected everybody to die at the end of Salem's Lot and at the end of The Shining. His favorite story, The Body. On his reading material, I read a lot of novels. I have a tendency to enjoy crime novels, suspense novels, and some horror novels, although I don't read as many horror novels as I used to. If I had to name a book that's made an impression on me lately, it would be Larry McMurtry's Lonesome Dove, which I liked very much. I just got around to reading for the first time Look Homeward, Angel by Thomas Wolfe. I loved that book. The guy didn't know how to say quit. He would turn to his typewriter and everything would vomit out. I can relate to that. On the novel, Misery. It's pretty accurate in terms of emotional feeling. I sometimes don't know what people want. People really like what I do, or at least some people do. But some of them are quite crackers. I have not met Annie Wilkes yet, but I've met all sorts of people who call themselves my number one fan, and boy, some of these guys don't have six cans in a six-pack. On selling his work to Hollywood. When you sell something to the movies, and I love the movies, it's immensely flattering to have somebody want to turn your book into a movie. There's two ways to go about it. Get involved all the way, or part of the way, and stand up and take the blame or criticism for everyone else. Or to say, "I'm going to sell it and take the money." But when you don't get involved, you're in a no-lose situation, because if it's good, you can say, "It's based on my work." But if it's bad, you can say, "I didn't have anything to do with that." On being typecast as a horror writer. All I can say is, I'm a horror writer if you want me to be one. You can call me anything you want to. I don't care. In America, everybody's got to have a brand name. You've got your generic game show host. You've got your generic Western writer. You've got your generic bad guy actor. And you've got your generic horror writer. I just write stories, but I tend to write horror stories. A few years ago, I tried very hard to write a Western because it's a form I like. I wrote about 160 pages, but the only scene that really had any power was when the old guy got drunk outside a farmhouse and fell into the pigsty and the pigs ate him. That one scene had some real drive and punch. That is what turned on my lights. For some reason, I don't understand. On his writing schedule, I write 2 or 3 hours in the morning. I crank up the music as high as I can. It keeps people away when you turn the music up loud because it poisons the air. On his taking a break from writing, I'd go crazy. I'm a creature of habit. On breaking into print, I'm not sure what you do about it. I was lucky enough to have a book that was adapted into a successful film, Carrie. I've always wondered what would happen if Carrie the film had been a failure. Would I be anywhere near where I am today? I like to think so, but who knows? I think it's something of a crapshoot, but I'll tell you one thing I believe. talent almost always finds the light, even today. If you need proof of that, look at Amy Tan, who is a fantastic success story and deserves every bit of it. I just wish as many people as know Amy Tan knew Katherine Dunn, who wrote Geek Love. On Writer's Block. I've had it twice. Shortly after Carrie, I went through a writer's block that was about a year long. And after I finished the Tommyknockers, I went through a year of hell that I would never want to go through again. Nothing would seem to come up. I would write and it would fall apart like wet tissue paper. I don't know how to describe it except to say that it's the most impotent, nasty, awful feeling. You feel like a batter in a slump. Finally, what happened was that I wrote a little story called Rainy Season in Nightmares and Dreamscapes, and all at once, everything opened up and flooded out. I've been writing horror ever since. 36. Different Seasons, 1982. The four stories in Different Seasons were written for love, not money, usually in between other writing projects. They have a pleasant, open-air feel, I think. Even at the grimmest moments, there's something about them, I hope, that says the writer was having a good time, hanging loose, worrying not about the storyteller, but only about the tale. Stephen King on Different Seasons, in a Walden Books publication, Book Notes. Stephen King's readers know that he has a penchant for addressing the reader directly in the forewords or afterwards of his short fiction collections. He began this practice with Night Shift, for which he wrote a lengthy piece that dovetailed the introduction by John D. MacDonald, whom he asked to write it. The practice of commenting on the fiction, so far as I can tell, was popularized by Harlan Ellison, whose prolific output of short fiction gave him ample opportunities to explain the story behind the stories, which he does in an entertaining and illuminating fashion. Readers, for the most part, like it when the author comes out of the shadows to shed light on the stories. It's as if you've met the writer at a bar afterward as he explains what happened behind the scenes. It's one reason why King's fans feel connected to him in a personal way, because his forewords and afterwards read as if they are long letters to the reader. And in a way, they are. In collections of short fiction, in which there's no explanatory text, the reader comes away with a distancing experience, because the author himself is out of sight. Typically, novels never have any explanatory text, which is a shame because there's much an author can say about a novel, its genesis and its connection to the real world, that readers would find interesting. In an introduction to a collection of his short fiction, Neil Gaiman, who, like Ellison and King, is also fond of writing introductions and afterwards, wrote in Smoke and Mirrors that stories are, in one way or another, mirrors. We use them to explain to ourselves how the world works or how it doesn't work. Like mirrors, stories prepare us for the day to come. They distract us from the things in the darkness. As Gaiman knows, writers hold up mirrors to reality. But they aren't ordinary mirrors, the kind most often used. A writer's mirror reflects different realities, showing us what could be or what could never be. It makes us see the world in a new, different light, as do the stories in this collection. In King's afterword to Different Seasons, he explicates an oft-asked question. Is horror all you write? His short answer is no. But a simple answer isn't what the audience wants to hear. An afterword is King's opportunity to have the reader's undivided attention and write the answers to these oft-asked questions at length, without the pressure of time at a public event. Although King answers both questions to most readers' satisfaction in this book's afterword, I'd like to add a few thoughts on the second question, because it strikes at the heart of this collection of four novellas. As King readily admits, usually with a long, deep sigh, Americans, and indeed the world, perceive of him as being, as he put it, America's best-loved boogeyman. It's a convenient label for people who haven't read his work, but only know of him as a household name because of his general reputation. They would likely be astonished if they only knew the wide range of his literary output. Poems, screenplays, non-fiction of all stripes, short fiction, novella-length fiction, novels. Certainly the element of fear is a thread that runs through most of his works, but horror takes many forms, both supernatural, of course, and real world. Horror, unfortunately, is an inextricable part of life, the dark side of human existence. Of the four stories in Different Seasons, only one has an element of supernatural horror, the last one, The Breathing Method, about a very unusual birth. The other stories explore non-supernatural horror. Rita Hayworth and Shawshank Redemption examines the horror of incarceration, of losing one's freedom, sustained by dim hope. Apt Pupil examines the parasitic and horrific relationship between a former Nazi concentration camp commandant and his impressionable protege, whose great interest in the gushy stuff is a whirlpool that sucks both teacher and pupil under. And The Body, a coming-of-age story that explores two young boys' fears of growing up only to be trapped in dead-end jobs in small towns. A fate almost worse than death. In other words, when someone asks King if horror is all he writes, the questioner is thinking about Salem's Lot, The Stand, The Mist, Cycle of the Werewolf, and other tales in which supernatural horror is obviously an element. I submit that King's enduring popularity stems in part from his refusal to write only supernatural horror, in which the monsters are external. Those books can be highly entertaining fiction, and popular in their own right. The Stand, in fact, is often cited by fans as their favorite King novel. But the stories in which the monsters are mortal are often more frightening because they are real. In Rita Hayworth and Shawshank Redemption, the warden of Shawshank Prison is a sanctimonious yet monstrous man who hides behind his piety and wields the Bible as a weapon, while behaving demonically. And in Apt Pupil, Todd Bowden's abnormal interest in sadism, in the suffering of Jewish concentration camp inmates, is horrific. His wholesome outward appearance contrasts sharply with the moral decay that rotted him from the inside out. The standout piece in this collection is The Body, a carefully nuanced tale whose narrator is Gordon LaChance, who grew up in Castle Rock and aspired to break free from the confines of that small main town. Gordon's fear is that he, like his friend Chris, will be trapped and never go beyond its restrictive confines, that he will never realize his dreams or fulfill his potential. Gordon's hope is that he will break free to realize his dream as a full-time freelance writer. Taken as a whole, this collection of stories stands among his best books. As Michael Collings wrote in The Stephen King Companion, 1995, the stories in Different Seasons are among King's most powerful mid-length works. Lacking the depth and breadth of the novels, they nevertheless allow King more scope than the short stories. Which brings us back to the original question. Is horror all that King writes? As this collection amply illustrates, obviously not. Michael Collings on Novellas from Different Seasons. Apt Pupil is appropriate as a companion piece to The Shining. In both stories, innocence is corrupted by pervasive evil. Jack Torrance's alcoholism is as destructive as Todd Bowden's obsession with the gushy parts of Kurt Dusander's Nazi past, and both aberrations lead the characters to insanity and murder, either potential or actual. The Breathing Method is a traditional winter's tale, a fireside story of single-minded determination, an internal connection among the four stories of Different Seasons, by the way. That results in a fracturing of what one assumes to be natural law. In its closing paragraphs, in fact, the breathing method expands until it comments elliptically, and with more than a touch of horror, on the nature of fiction and storytelling itself. Rita Hayworth and Shawshank Redemption. In spite of its horrific setting, Shawshank Prison, with its concrete walls and cruel, sometimes stupid wardens and guards, and its bands of sisters whose lives are devoted to viciousness, rape, and violence, Rita Hayworth and Shawshank Redemption paradoxically comes across not as an exercise in gritty realism, but almost as an attempt at idealism, as seen through the eyes of a hardened inmate. Andy Dufresne brings light to the darkness, a strong gentleness that opposes the stone walls surrounding him. His ultimate escape becomes not only a justified consequence of his patient endurance of a judicial injustice, but also a tribute to the indomitable human spirit. The Body. Of the four stories, the most resonant is The Body, perhaps because it is the more familiar to recent readers through Rob Reiner's superlative film adaptation, Stand By Me. Again, told without any substantive recourse to supernatural horror, The Body is a semi-autobiographical story of a young would-be author finding in himself and his experiences the stuff of true storytelling. Restrained, symbolic, even apocalyptic in the etymological sense of uncovering that which is hidden, The Body is a remarkable achievement. With only minimal plotting, it nevertheless provides riveting portraits of boys on the verge of becoming men, of children confronting adult realities, and of the necessary transition from innocence into experience. 37. The Road to the Dark Tower. Roland's Quest. I'm never done with The Dark Tower. The thing about The Dark Tower is that those books were never edited, so I look at them as first drafts. And by the time I got to the fifth or sixth book, I'm thinking to myself, this is really all one novel. It drives me crazy. The thing is to try to find the time to rewrite them. There's a missing element, a big battle at a place called Jericho Hill, and that whole thing should be written. And I've thought about it several times, and I don't know how to get into it. Stephen King, Rolling Stone, November 6th, 2014. A Chance Encounter. The longest journey begins with the first step. And so it was that in 1970, when King was a senior in college, he began writing what would prove to be his magnum opus, a massive work that still occupies his mind. Nearly five decades later, King is still drawn back to Roland's world and impelled to write about a big battle at Jericho Hill. Dark Tower fans are already anxiously waiting its eventual publication. The Dark Tower story began when King had gotten odd-sized, thick, lime-green paper that he fed through a battered Underwood typewriter. Then living in a cabin near the Androscoggin River in Orono, King began the first chapter of what would be published as The Dark Tower, The Gunslinger, and showed them to Chris Chesley, who was impressed and told King so. Serialized in The Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction, the novel appeared in five installments, starting with The Gunslinger, followed by The Way Station, The Oracle and the Mountains, The Slow Mutants, and The Gunslinger and the Dark Man. Donald M. Grant, publisher. The director of publications at Providence College in Rhode Island, Donald M. Grant wore a different hat away from the office. He was the publisher of a small press in the fantasy-slash-horror field. Best known at the time for publishing Robert E. Howard's fiction, Grant got to talking with King at a college dinner and asked him if he had anything suitable for his small press. King offered the Dark Tower stories, which he felt was similar to the kind of books Grant had previously published. King also felt that the subject matter of The Dark Tower was sufficiently a departure from his horror novels that a small press and its correspondingly small audience was the only way to go. The Dark Tower, King felt, wouldn't appeal to his mainstream readers. The novel, as Grant wrote, begged for illustrations, and both Grant and King agreed that Michael Whalen was their first choice. Michael had previously illustrated the wraparound cover for the Fantasia Press edition of Firestarter. As Grant explained to me, we both thought that Michael was at the top of the game, and King certainly liked Michael's work, so we were in accord there. King was very pleased with the finished artwork, Grant recalled. The book went into pre-production, and the early word among fans was that no true fan of fantasy and horror could afford to pass up this book. Grant sent out a full-color brochure to people on his mailing list, telling them about King's new novel. Written over a period of 12 years, The Dark Tower, The Gunslinger is the first cycle of stories in a remarkable epic, the strangest and most frightening work that Stephen King has ever written. It is the book of Roland, the last gunslinger, and his quest for the Dark Tower in a world in which time has no bearing. Against the weird background of a devastated and dying planet, with curious ties to our own world, the last gunslinger pursued the man in black. It is a time when man's thirst for knowledge has been lost, and the haunted, chilling land harbors strange beings. The slow mutants, less than human troglodytes dwelling in the darkness. A speaking demon, laired beneath a forgotten way station, and a nameless vampiric presence, held captive in an ancient circle of altar stones. Herein lies a tale of science fantasy that is unlike anything best-selling author Stephen King has ever written. Indeed, it is unlike anything anyone else has ever written. King fans rushed to place orders for the book. The editor and publisher of the semi-prozine Whispers, Stuart David Schiff, wrote in the August 1982 issue about Grant's latest offering. He noted, "I am not a partner with Donald Grant, although I would certainly like the opportunity to join up. Still, my never-ending praise for his publications might make it appear I have a financial interest in his press. The reality of the situation is that Don does great work, and as such, deserves praise. He has just produced what might possibly be the most important book ever from a specialty press. It is Stephen King's The Dark Tower, The Gunslinger, HC $20, signed by author and artist, 500 copies, $60, as illustrated by Hugo Award winner Michael Whalen. The book is an epic tale, weird and unlike anything else King has written. The Whalen artwork is superb. The trade hardcover has only a 10,000 copy run. No sarcasm is intended by my quotation marks. King's hardcovers normally sell many times that number, so the book may sell out quickly. Regarding the materials, Don has spared no expense. The paper is special. There are colored pictorial endpapers, five-color plates, and the usual other expertise the field has come to expect from Grant. Do not miss this book. The first printing of 10,500 copies, 10,000 plus 500 signed / numbered, were immediately snatched up by fans. To issue such a book, of course, is one of the few ways I have of saying that I am not entirely for sale, wrote King in an essay for Castle Rock in 1985, that I'm still in the business for the joy of it, and that I have not been entirely subsumed by the commercial juggernaut I have cheerfully fueled and set in motion. The ones who missed out were the King readers at large who bought his trade editions from bookstores because they were unaware of the specialty presses that catered to fandom. The Dark Tower quietly went out of print. King was happy. The fantasy fans were happy, and Donald M. Grant, the publisher, was happy as well. But he would have been even happier if King had allowed a larger print run, because he knew the demand far exceeded the supply. The best he could hope for was a second printing, if King agreed. Unlike most of the books Grant had previously issued, with much smaller print runs, which sold slowly over the years, mainly through book dealers in the field, The Dark Tower was a bestseller. It was, as is every signed limited edition King book, a license to print money. The Firestorm. When Pet Sematary went out into the world in 1983, with a first printing of a 250,000 copies in hardback, it alerted King's larger readership that he had previously published The Dark Tower. Opposite Pet Sematary's title page was the obligatory listing of previous published books written by Stephen King. Broken down by category, novels, collections, nonfiction, and screenplay, one title in particular stood out, The Dark Tower, 1982. There was no mention of the publisher, which added to the mystery. King's constant readers were shocked to discover that there had been a King novel that they somehow had missed out on. The firestorm began. Where can I get The Dark Tower? Readers besieged his publishers, Doubleday, New American Library, Viking, chain bookstores, and also King's office. When they found out Donald Grant was its publisher, they deluged him with letters asking how they could buy copies. King was adamant that because The Dark Tower had limited appeal, it wouldn't please his mainstream readers, who were accustomed to his horror novels. He therefore refused to allow further printings. "I didn't think anybody would want to read it," King explained in Castle Rock. "It wasn't like the other books. The first volume didn't have any firm grounding in our world, in reality. It was more like a Tolkien fantasy of some other world." The other reason was that it wasn't done. It wasn't complete. "I wanted to do something about it," King explained at a public talk in Pasadena. "And Don wanted to do something about it. He was upset. We talked on the phone one night, and I said, 'What if you published another 500 or 5,000? There was a long sigh, and I said, "That would be like pissing on a forest fire, wouldn't it?" He said, "Yeah." But as the firestorm spread, King reluctantly allowed Grant to go back to press. Another 10,000 copies were printed, with priority going to people who specifically had written to King to request information on where to buy it. Like the first, the second printing was immediately snapped up. Once again, the demand far exceeded the supply, and it quickly went out of print. King finally changed his mind, and in 1998, New American Library published The Dark Tower, The Gunslinger, in an inexpensive edition to ensure as many people as possible could afford to buy it. The book featured a new painting by Michael Whalen depicting Roland with the Dark Tower in the background. The book also reprinted the interior art from the Grant edition. Now the question was no longer, where can I buy it, but when is the next one coming out? On his official website, King answered, "I am going to continue the Dark Tower series, mostly because I have three women who work in my office that answer the fan mail, and a lot of times they don't tell me what's going on with the fan mail, except for the stuff that I pick up myself. But they put every Dark Tower letter on my desk. This is like a silent protest saying, 'Get these people off our backs.' But my plan this time, if all goes well, is just to continue working until the cycle is done, and then that way I can walk away from that. It's always been my intention to finish. There isn't a day that goes by that I don't think about Roland and Eddie and Detta and all the other people, even Oi, the little animal. But this book has never done what I wanted it to do. I've been living with these guys longer than the readers have, ever since college, actually. And that's a long time ago for me. I want to finish it. But there are no guarantees in this business. I can walk out of here today and get hit by a bus, and that would be the end of that. Unless it came into somebody by a Ouija board, which is always a possibility. But the other thing is, I can try and find out that the words aren't there anymore. I don't think that will happen, but you never know till you open the cupboard. Michael Collings on The Dark Tower, The Gunslinger. The man in black fled across the desert, and the gunslinger followed. These sparse words begin the most atypical and in some ways the most imaginative narrative yet to come from King's pen. The first volume in what promises to be the longest, most complex story from an author whose trademark has become long, complex tales. As with so many King texts, the basic story of The Dark Tower, The Gunslinger, is simplicity itself. The Gunslinger, Roland of Gilead, has been, is, and, so far as the readers can tell at the beginning, always will be pursuing the Dark Man, a shadowy, quasi-mythic figure that holds the secrets to Roland's ultimate quest, the Dark Tower, an even more darkly shadowed, more vaguely mythic nexus of worlds, universes, and ultimate possibilities. The quest for the Dark Man has led Roland from the ruins of his own country, where the world has irrevocably moved on, into a vast desert near the far edge of the world. Crossing the desert, he undergoes sore trials and temptations, meeting eventually with Jake, a mysterious young boy from another world who helps Roland survive and whom Roland in turn grows to love. But he cannot love Jake as much as he loves, or is obsessed with, the Dark Tower. When the brutal choice between Jake's life and his quest forces itself upon him, Roland barely hesitates before sacrificing Jake in order to confront the Dark Man. At the end of this first installment of the story, Roland has gleaned secret knowledge from the Dark Man and sits beside the Western Sea, awaiting dreams of the Dark Tower and the time of the drawing of the three. The afterword to The Dark Tower, The Gunslinger, explains that the projected plot outline for the remainder of the story would take nearly 3,000 pages to complete. And given the time it took to complete the first volume, King would have to live approximately 300 years to complete the tale of the tower. It also apologizes for the fact that The Dark Tower series is not exactly what King's readers have come to expect from him. In many ways, however, that is precisely the strength of the series, especially this first volume. Coming from the pen of a writer whose popular image is of a single-minded purveyor of cheap horror and the even cheaper gross-out, whose style is often condemned as wooden and workmanlike at best, whose books are condemned as overwritten and under-edited, The Dark Tower, The Gunslinger is a pleasant surprise. There are certainly elements of King's trademark horror. The Slow Mutants, for example, resemble strongly similar characters in The Talisman, and are described in terms familiar to King's readers, while Roland's first response to them is the equally familiar atavistic crawl in his intestines and privates, often associated with moments of horror in King's novels. And of course, there is the sense that this volume is merely the beginning of the longest novel yet, one whose ending is so far distant as to be lost in the mists that obscure the Dark Tower itself. But as an individual work, The Dark Tower, The Gunslinger, undercuts many readers' presuppositions about King. It is written in unusually spare diction, ranging from typically coarse colloquialisms to carefully constructed analogs of the refined language of high fantasy. There are few narrative digressions in the novel, and few lines and phrases that do not move the story forward. It is, in fact, the shortest of the Dark Tower series thus far, and among King's shorter novels. Beyond the level of style, however, is the larger issue of genre. While King occasionally blends horror with other genres, with mainstream pseudo-documentary fiction in Carrie or with science fiction in The Long Walk, in The Dark Tower series, he sets himself the ambitious task of combining horror with the Western. Roland is, after all, the last gunslinger. The action-adventure thriller, touches of the romance in both the contemporary and the medieval senses, alternate universe and multiple universe extrapolative speculations, philosophical debate, heroic saga, apocalyptic fantasy, and, above all, the epic quest. Browning's Child Roland to the Dark Tower Came provides a character and a focus for the quest, but King's imagination fills out the spare outlines into a rich tapestry of worlds, some dying, others, ours included, not yet fully aware of an unnamed threat to the Dark Tower itself. Browning also supplies the epic form, but King's imagination again transforms it into prose narrative of a sort rarely attempted. The epic impulse itself is almost as old as literature, extending at least as far back as the Epic of Gilgamesh, inscribed in clay tablets with cuneiform script some 4,000 years ago. During much of Western history, the epic stood at a pinnacle of human achievement, with works such as Homer's Iliad and Odyssey, Virgil's Aeneid, the Anglo-Saxon Beowulf, Ludovico Ariosto's Orlando Furioso, Luis de Camões' Lusiad, Edmund Spenser's The Faerie Queen, and Sir Philip Sidney's prose Arcadia, continuously transforming the genre to meet new requirements of new audiences. Until its culmination in John Milton's Paradise Lost, the epic reigned virtually unchallenged as the highest literary form, at least for Renaissance audiences. After Milton's superlative achievement, however, verse epic almost disappeared, except for such inverted mock epic masterpieces as Alexander Pope's The Rape of the Lock and The Dunciad, and Lord Byron's Don Juan. Serious verse epic simply could not force language, structure, and theme beyond the point to which Milton developed them. To all appearances, verse epic ceased to be a viable literary form. The need for epic itself did not disappear, however, but reappeared in a startling new 18th century genre, the novel. Until the end of the 19th century and the novel's descent into realism, naturalism, and the anti-heroic, the quest for a hero found its outlet in long prose narratives, and in the 20th century that impulse was rapidly transferred from the mainstream novel to the science fiction/fantasy novel, in works as disparate as J.R.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings and Frank Herbert's Dune, in which the actions of a single individual could, in fact, make a difference. Could even save the world, the solar system, or the universe itself. It is this literary heritage that lies behind the Dark Tower novels, beginning with The Gunslinger. King has created an archetypal epic personage whose past lies hidden in myth and legend and whose future is wedded completely to the object of his quest. King's fable resonates with epic scope and grandeur, particularly in Roland's dream vision of the tower and its casual relation to all things. In good epic fashion, King expands the vision of his tale until it potentially represents an encyclopedia of the culture in which it is written. And in The Drawing of the Three and The Wastelands, volumes 2 and 3 of the saga, that potential becomes actual as King anatomizes the strengths and weaknesses of American society over the past 3 decades, thrusting Roland into contact with the 1960s, the 1970s, and the 1980s. Through Roland, King examines our obsessions and our frustrations, our hopes and our dreams, our successes and our failures, all from the perspective of an epic character out of this time and out of this place. Roland's perspectives on our world transform the everyday into the alien, giving readers continuing glimpses into who and what we are. The long publication process. As King explained in the introduction to The Little Sisters of Illyria, originally a short story published as a separate book in 2009, which included a rewritten version of the first Dark Tower novel published in 1982, I had no idea of how things were going to turn out with the gunslinger and his friends. To know, I have to write. In other words, the stories would come when they came, and that proved to be an ongoing frustration to readers. and to King Two, who was besieged with never-ending queries until Roland reached the Dark Tower in 2004 and blew his horn. The publication timetable of the Dark Tower novels from Donald M. Grant Publisher stretched over a period of 22 years, from The Dark Tower, The Gunslinger in 1982 to The Dark Tower in 2004. The Wind Through the Keyhole, the eighth Dark Tower novel, which fits into the plot between Volume 4 and 5, was published in 2012. What accelerated the publication schedule was the accident on June 19, 1999. Struck by a minivan near his home in Center Lovell, Maine, King subsequently endured a slow, painful recovery. That unexpected event emphasized the fragility of life, which hangs on a thread. It gave King the impetus to get the series completed. The cycle is now complete, at least for the time being. In an interview with Rolling Stone, November 6, 2014, King said that he feels impelled to rewrite the books because they feel like first drafts. It remains to be seen whether he will devote precious time rewriting a previously published saga that readers already feel is complete. The wild card, though, is that in the same interview, King says there's one major book as yet unwritten in the series, depicting the Battle of Jericho Hill.